Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the death of conservatism, a movement that, and its consequences, a prescient book by Sam Tannenhaus, a columnist at Prospect Magazine, who previously was the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review section of the Times. He joins us to discuss what appears to be the fracturing of the Republican Party and other traditional conservative parties in Europe, where in the UK, UKIP is making gains at the expense of the Conservative Party as Le Pen's National Front in France also surges. We will look into the phenomenon that the leading candidate for president on the Republican side has tenuous connections to the GOP at best, while on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders is the longest-serving independent in U.S. history and a self-described Democratic socialist. Then we'll go to Iowa for an update on the last-minute campaigning ahead of tomorrow's Iowa caucus. David Redlawsk, the author of Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process, who is currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, joins us. We will examine the latest Des Moines Register poll that has Trump and Hillary Clinton in the lead. Then we'll go to Switzerland to speak with Leonard Doyle, the Director of Media and Communication and spokesperson for the Director General of the International Organization for Migration, about the alarming report from Europol, the EU's police intelligence unit, that more than 10,000 children may have disappeared after arriving in Europe in the migrant tide from the Middle East over the past 2 years. We will look into the possibility that many were taken by human traffickers to be dragged into slavery, sex work, and other criminal activities. Then finally, we'll go to speak with Lauren Windsor, who is standing outside the luxury resort in Indian Wells near Palm Springs that the Koch brothers have taken over for a weekend gathering of the Koch network of billionaire donors who have spent more than $400 million in 2015 to elect politicians who will do their bidding. The executive director of American Family Voices, Lauren Windsor, has managed to infiltrate the last two secret Koch conclaves, but this year she has been targeted by Koch security and forced to report from the sidewalk outside the luxury resort. And joining us now is Sam Tannenhaus, who's a columnist for Prospect Magazine. He previously was the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review section of the Times, and he's the author of The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Tannenhaus.
Hi, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And Sam, what do you make of this extraordinary phenomenon that I mentioned in the opening, that the two leading candidates, at least at this moment, and obviously it's in flux and we'll know more tomorrow night, but you've got Bernie Sanders, the longest serving independent in U.S. history and a self-described Democratic socialist who in some polls certainly in most polls is ahead in New Hampshire and in some is ahead in Iowa. And then, of course, you've got the phenomenon of Donald Trump, who appears to be on a roll and likely to steamroller his way to the nomination. His Republican credentials are somewhat dubious.
Yes, they are. And it's interesting, if we start with Trump, Ian, we see something that should have happened a while ago and maybe was building and is now more obvious, which is a split between the Republican Party on the one hand and what's called movement conservatism on the other. That is the ideological right. Trump, it's interesting, attracts some support at this late or early date. It's one of the paradoxes of this election that nobody's voted yet. We're many months into it. At this point, there are some traditional Republicans, former office holders, people like Bob Dole and Trent Lott, who are very visible, but now kind of emeritus figures who actually are more comfortable with Trump than they might be with an ideologue like Ted Cruz. Whereas the intellectual conservatives, the ideological conservatives, of publications like National Review and the Weekly Standard are terrified of Trump because they think he's not really conservative. So this long-standing alliance between ideological conservatism on the one hand and the Republican Party as its vehicle are coming apart. But the Democrats were seeing something a little different, which is that a candidate, a very visible figure like Hillary Clinton, who you could say is the most conspicuously dominant Democratic figure in modern politics. She's a huge historic figure, is being strongly challenged by someone, Sanders, who makes a stronger ideological argument than she does. So together what we're seeing maybe is the weakening of these two parties in our system.
But this phenomenon appears to also be happening in Europe, where I also mentioned in the opening that UKIP is making gains on the conservative parties and also Le Pen in France is on a roll, and on the left you've got Podemos and Syriza and others splitting off the left, and Corwin, of course, taking the Labour Party to the left, which has people like Tony Blair in having conniption. So it's
fascinating. Yep, this is a moment where American politics can no longer pretend it's different from European politics. I mean, Trump sounds like Le Pen. You know, the distrust of immigrants, the defense of this kind of embattled white population, this kind of racial purity and all the rest. Our politics sounds a lot more like European politics. That's an ironic result, maybe, of the globalized economy. We have all the populations, all the countries have the same kind of population of displaced and anxious people who come from an earlier generation used to the kind of emoluments and provisions of the welfare state, which are now being challenged, even as those same countries depend on immigrants to do the work nobody else wants to do. America, you know, it's funny, in 2012, Mitt Romney and other Republicans would denounce Barack Obama and say, well, he's turning America into France and all the rest. Now we have Republican politicians who sound like right-wing French politicians.
So what do you attribute this phenomenon to? Obviously, one of the things that's alarming is that when people, and we know there's widespread disgust with Washington and the gridlock and the polarization, and I think the Congress has about 8% support, and you wonder who those 8% are, frankly. The usually when this phenomenon occurs, that people turn to more illiberal forms, as they did in the 30s in Germany. And in Italy, I'm not suggesting we're heading towards an American fascism, but we're certainly in the form of Trump heading towards an American right-wing populism.
Yes. Well, what do we attribute it to? A number of things you've mentioned. One, which is that the government doesn't seem to work. You know, it's interesting that Trump, who began and, you know, gained traction by denouncing immigrants in very strong, almost, you know, pornographically offensive terms, is now talking about what a great deal maker and negotiator he is. That he's the guy who could work with Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and get bills passed. He is someone who's really outside our normal ideology, but very good at tapping into anxieties and resentment. I think so. Part of it is the idea that the government doesn't work. Another is really dramatically changing demographics that unites us with Europe. In 2030 or so, America will no longer be a, quote, white majority, unquote, country. The millennial cohort, which everyone talks about, seems fixated on, and which Bernie Sanders is very good at attracting, is larger than the baby boom population, some 85 million people, 43% of whom are non-white. So there are those pressures, in addition to which, as far as the Republicans go, for a long time they have played a very tricky game, the party and the ideologues attached to it, which is to attack government, denounce Democrats, denounce policies that are meant to help the poor or to prop up the middle class. They've been doing this for a really long time, and what's happened is politicians have now come out of the woodwork who appeal to the same groups they've been targeting all along, only they don't like that conservative establishment either. That's why you see, the editors at National Review or the Weekly Standard, or columnists like George Will and Charles Krauthammer, horrified by the rise of Donald Trump, when in fact what he says is just a popularized version as much as what they said for a really long time. And then you see a Republican Party, as opposed to the intellectuals, party officials who are more frightened, actually, by Ted Cruz, whom we haven't talked about so much. And then you put Trump and Cruz together, and at least in polls, we don't know how anybody's voting, but at least in polls so far, the two of them command well over 50% of the support. So two fairly extreme characters have emerged to dominate the Republican Party, and they don't know what to do about it. The genie is out of the bottle, and it's been building for a really long time. Here's an example. A good columnist like Ralph Douthat at the New York Times, conservative columnist, very thoughtful, tried to remind readers that conditions are not really so terrible today. So why should we have this kind of angry, authoritarian populist like Donald Trump? Well, Ross, because many conservatives, not you, but some of your colleagues and allies, for 8 years now have been telling us how evil Barack Obama is and how the country is going to the dogs. So now you have politicians who come out and say exactly that. You should not be surprised by that. And this is what the conservative movement in our country, in the United States, has not reckoned with, is their own complicity in all of this.
Well, Sam Tenenhouse, in terms of your book, The Death of Conservatism, a Movement and Its Consequences, which I mentioned is very prescient given what we're talking about, at what point do we see the crack up of the GOP, if that's inevitable? My sense is that as Trump makes more gains, and if he wins tomorrow in Iowa, there'll be kind of panic. We've seen it already. But when the establishment has to trot out its elders, the GOP elders, the wise men, who have they got apart from George W. Bush?
Well, that is a real problem. You're absolutely right. And you asked, when do we know? We could know tomorrow. We could know in 24 hours or 36 hours where we are now. As you know very well, Ian, and your listeners do too, we have New Hampshire a week later and then South Carolina. And none of that will be definitive, but it will set the story, the narrative, on its course. It seems fairly clear now, and it has for a while, that what the Republican establishment has hoped is that Marco Rubio, right, could come to the fore, that Jeb Bush would step aside and let him through, that others would fall away, Kasich and Chris Christie. The problem is twofold. One is Trump and Cruz together have been so successful at this early stage that even if the others left, it still wouldn't create a majority for whoever remains. Let's say it's Rubio. The second is because of the politics we have, thanks to Citizens United and the Roberts Court, that allows huge sums of money from Sheldon Adelson and others to go into the process. People can be kept artificially afloat for a really long time and drag the nomination out. So the party has really lost control over its own process. You know, there's this a book, kind of a truism that many like to repeat at election time, which is that the party selects, the party decides who will be the nominee. Now we've come to a point when that's not happening with the Republicans. As far as the Democrats go, remember, there are only two really strong candidates. The third, Martin O'Malley, is attracting no support. Hillary Clinton has been getting over 50% in polls all the way through. Bernie Sanders, in a brilliant way, has changed the debate, made strong appeals. The Democratic Party is still functioning more or less the way we expect a traditional party in our two-party system to do it. It's the Republicans that have become gripped in a kind of nihilism, and we really do not know. It can change almost daily. And so it's fascinating to watch, but also a little scary.
Well, Sam Tenenhouse, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always good to talk to you, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. And again, I've been speaking with Sam Tenenhouse, who's a columnist at Prospect Magazine and a contributor to Bloomberg, who previously was the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review section of the Times. From 1999 to 2004, he was a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and his books, Whitaker Chambers, a biography, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. And his latest book is The Death of Conservatism, a Movement and Its Consequences. And joining us now is David Redlawsk, who's a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process, and he's currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Redlawsk.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And, of course, your university that you're now affiliated with or visiting, David, is Drake University. They hosted Donald Trump in his competing appearance the other night where for the vets that was up against the Fox News presidential debate that he boycotted. Yeah. And, of course, he did, like all clever politicians on the stump. He booked a small hall so that you'd have hundreds of thousands of people lined up outside, which is the case. So, but according to the latest Bloomberg Des Moines Register Selzer poll, which everybody I think says is the gold standard, Trump is in the lead, right? With Ted Cruz. He's got Trump at 28%, Ted Cruz at 23%. Right. And on the Democratic side, you got Hillary Clinton at 45% and Bernie Sanders at 42%. So is that your understanding of the latest polling?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And the Des Moines Register poll really is seen as the gold standard. Ann Selzer, who runs that poll, has a pretty good record. I mean, you know, things happened in the last weekend, and so it's not perfect, but it's a pretty darn good record. You know, the interesting thing about Donald Trump and the polling is we don't know how much of those numbers for Trump really represent deeply seated support for him and how much represent people naming him because he's the only thing the media talks about. And we don't know whether those folks who are many of his supporters are not regular caucus goers. They're not even regular voters. Are they going to show up tomorrow night when they have to be in a certain place at a certain time? That's the big unknown right now on the Republican side.
But I take it in a mirroring situation to some extent, that's also the big unknown on the Democratic side with Bernie Sanders, the youth vote that he has certainly motivated. Is it likely that all the students will cut class tomorrow, Monday, and go to the caucuses?
Well, you know, the issue of excitement, it's one thing to be excited. It's another thing to turn it into action. And in the case of Bernie Sanders, his support does skew younger. He's very, very popular on the college campuses in Iowa. They don't have to skip classes for the most part to caucus. That doesn't happen until 7 p.m., but the Sanders campaign would like the Iowa students to go home, to go 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever it is to their hometowns to caucus. And the reason they want them to do that is because the way the Democrats work, you can actually have too many people in a precinct. You have extra voters that don't do you much good in electing delegates. So he'd like to send them home. I'm a little bit dubious about the chances of that happening, but, you know, you never know.
And as you mentioned, David Redlawsk, again, a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University and author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. He's currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And as we've spoken before, David, you've met every candidate more than once, and you've been our guy on the ground there. And you mentioned that Trump's people have never voted before, many of them, and they're not certainly registered as Republicans. A lot of them are independent, and they may not be reliable. What's he doing in terms of a ground game to overcome that?
Well, it seems to me that they got a ground game started, but they got it started rather late. And to a great extent, it's relying primarily on telephone banking and email. Telephone work can certainly help, but in Iowa, the ground game normally includes literally knocking on people's doors. We're only talking, 125, 150,000, maybe a little bit more Republicans showing up. If you're going to win 30% of them, that's 45,000 voters. You actually can put an army together to knock on every door. There isn't evidence that that's happening with the Trump campaign. The other interesting thing about their huge events, and I think this absolutely was true at Drake, a large percentage of people in line were not there because they supported Trump. They were there for the spectacle, the excitement, and because, here's an interesting opportunity. And so we just don't know. And I'll also say that ground games, whether Republican or Democrat, fly very much under the radar. And I think in a world of social media, they're even more under the radar. We can't see those social media connections very well.
Well, I was reading a piece at the Huffington Post about Democrats who plan to vote for Donald Trump. And it profiles a woman who had voted for Hillary last time, but was going to vote for Trump this time. And she's waiting at Dubuque's airport for Trump to arrive. And his big Boeing 757 jet with his name emblazoned on it flies low over the crowd. They all go ecstatic. And then the plane lands and taxis up. And she's basically repeating in this article in the Huffington Post titled "A Democrat Explains Why She's Voting for Donald Trump," that she's repeating him. I want to take our country back. That's the main thing. It's our country.
Yeah.
And we're getting screwed. I'm surprised. I know Bernie Sanders is talking about it, but Hillary's not. Mm-hmm. Is this idea that people really feel that insecure about their jobs, particularly in the Rust Belt and what's left of the manufacturing sector? Yeah. They say, our jobs are going to China and Mexico, which is, of course, why Trump is demonizing Mexico and China.
Absolutely, yeah. I've said this a number of times to folks. In some ways, Trump is Sanders and Sanders is Trump. They are both attracting very similar emotional responses, people who are frustrated and angry and worried and feel that Washington hasn't worked for them. Some unknown other is controlling their lives. And for Trump, of course, that other is things like China and Mexico and corporations who refuse to stay here in America. And for Bernie Sanders, well, it isn't that side exactly. It's the rigged economy, which is also, of course, corporations and Wall Street. And it fascinates me how similar the pitch is, even though it's to opposite sides on the political spectrum. The bottom line for the Donald Trump effect here, though, to keep in mind, for all of our talking about him and all of the media coverage and the fact that, it's all Donald all the time, the latest Des Moines Register poll says 72% of Iowa Republicans want someone else. And that puts it in interesting perspective.
You mean anybody but all of the above in this crowded field?
Well, my sense is, 28% say Donald Trump and 72% say somebody else, one of the others. But it looks great for Trump because there are 10 other candidates to split that vote, right? And as a consequence, we're looking at Donald Trump as this runaway winner when he's barely in Iowa ever broken 30%.
So what's your sense then Well, let me ask you what your prediction would be. I know you've studied the polls, and my sense is that I think that Hillary may actually pull this one off. But on the Trump side, it's really hard, even though you've mentioned this caveat of people that support him have never voted before. Yeah. They're independents. They have to show up at these caucuses. They have to register as Republicans before they can even caucus. So it may not work out for him. But if not, who's going to come in second? I mean, Trump, what's his name? Cruz has taken a dive, hasn't he?
Yeah. This is the thing, right? The old line, prediction is hard, especially about the future, absolutely applies here. I tend to think that Hillary is likely to pull it out. I give her the odds to pull it out here in Iowa, partly because of that geography I was talking about, partly because in the end, I think there's a better ground game for Clinton, although I don't know that for sure. On the Republican side, for Trump to lose, there has to be an alternative. And it did look like it was going to be Ted Cruz, that he was gathering evangelical support, that others were giving him a good, serious look. He had a terrible week. He had a terrible, terrible week. And so in that terrible week, it included a pretty bad performance in the debate, a mailer that went out here in Iowa yesterday or the day before that is an appalling mailer, and you know, he's just been beaten up. So if Cruz isn't the alternative, who is it? Marco Rubio, maybe, but the poll at least gives no evidence of a surge for Marco Rubio. That may be Trump's best bet. The fact that Republicans are so split on the alternatives, you know, there's no obvious person for them to go to.
So what was this appalling mailer that Ted Cruz put out?
Oh, his campaign, and it is from the campaign, read some social science research on what we call social pressure in voting. That is, you tell people that, you know, you haven't voted before very often and you really should get out and vote and we'll score you on it. This has been done. Political scientists have tested it, have found that it can have effects. But the actual mailer tells everybody, apparently, because I've talked to several people who've gotten it, that they're voting record is poor. They get an F grade for voting, for turning out. And their neighbors are, the names of their neighbors are on it as well, real names, but with fake data about their actual voting. And it's a very under the radar thing, but it's starting to gain some traction. Whether it's a little too late to affect things is unclear.
Well, it sounds like Rubio was right in that debate, saying that Cruz will do anything to get elected and say anything. And in this case, print anything.
And print anything, yeah.
Right. That's pretty appalling. Well, just in closing, though, is there for the Bernie Sanders supporters listening in, what's your sense of whether he can get these students to go home or whatever, what's it going to take for him to pull it out? He's only a couple of points behind.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, even though I give Hillary the odds, it certainly wouldn't surprise me if Sanders pulls it off. A lot depends on how concentrated his support is, whether most of his support is in a limited number of counties, in which case he will not get as many delegates to the convention as his support might indicate. And it's a complex explanation as to why. But the bottom line is this sending kids home thing becomes an important part of that calculation. I think there is some sense, in some places at least, these kids would probably do anything for Bernie, but the logistics of doing it are challenging.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Redlawsk.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Redlawsk, who's a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's co-author of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he's currently a fellow at the Harkin Institute at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And we're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Switzerland to speak with Leonard Doyle, with spokesperson for the Director General of the International Organization for Migration, about the alarming report from Europol, the EU's police intelligence unit, that more than 10,000 children from the migrant tide have gone missing.
You don't need to change the future. You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your vote.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land. unto which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
And joining us now is Linda Doyle, the Director of Media and Communications and a spokesperson for the Director General at the International Organization for Migration in Switzerland. Welcome to Background Briefing, Linda Doyle.
Thanks for having me on. We're with the International Organization for Migration, which is a global organization, you know, helping migrants around the world and dealing in emergencies and wars and most recently in the terribly sad traffic of millions of people into the European Union because of wars and other issues around the world.
But what's really alarming now is that it's emerging that 10,000 children who are from this tide of migrants, the 1 million that you mentioned, have disappeared after arriving in Europe over the past 2 years. That's according to EU police intelligence unit known as Europol. So how exact is that figure? I mean, even if it's not only a fraction of that, it's an appalling statistic.
Well, I think it's probably not a surprise to those who work in this space because for anybody who's been watching, you'll have seen that the numbers of children, minors that are accompanied and unaccompanied who've been coming across is generally about a third of the population of refugees and migrants. And these people are left to their own devices. There's not exactly a warm welcome or a kinder transport to look after them. So they're at loose in the European system. They have no money. Many of them have asylum claims that are unlikely to be recognized. So the idea that they become, you know, prey to criminal gangs is alarming and indeed not entirely surprising.
Well, according to Save the Children, 26,000 child migrants arrived in Europe last year without any family. And it seems that some criticism that in Greece, where most of them first arrived, there's not a particularly watertight registration process. So how do you know in the first place how many people are arriving?
What happens is when people have come across on those pathetic rubber dinghies that you see where they've paid vast amounts of money to smugglers to get them in, they are typically registered by the Greek authorities and by the European Union. But the registration has been pretty slipshod, you know, for a long time. And the aim of that is so that they move on to other countries, because neither Greece nor Italy, the two frontline states, if you will, really want to have the responsibility of looking after these refugees and migrants. So it's not exactly an exact science, but the numbers are nonetheless pretty good. And they can tell the age of the people coming through as well.
Well, according to Italian officials, and they warned back in May of 2015 that almost 5,000 children have disappeared from asylum reception centres in Italy since the previous summer. So apparently the alarm has been raised earlier. Your organisation, the International Organisation for Migration, seem to be on top of this. So give me a sense of how long this has been on the radar in terms of Europol. And what's the sense now of what kind of police work can be done to track down, you know, if 10,000 is the figure, that's an awful lot of children that have gone missing.
Indeed. Well, I mean, the asylum system is based basically on open asylum centers. So quite unlike the United States, where people who are found to be in irregular status are often locked up. In Europe, it's typically an open center. People can stay. They have facilities and they can come and go during the day, not necessarily to work, but they can hang around downtown or they can, you know, basically be free. So the idea that many of them disappear if they get wind of or if they hear that they're getting an unfavorable asylum claim is not really surprising. They don't want to go back to Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq, for that matter, or any other country. So the idea that a 16-year-old would basically take to their heels doesn't surprise me in the slightest. What is worrying, though, is that Europol is suggesting that some of them fall into the hands of children of those who are traffickers or involved in the sex trade and what have you. So that is obviously very concerning.
And I assume that the traffickers know where these asylum centers are, these hostels or whatever, where these children
are. Yeah,
from.
I mean, they're typically on the wrong side of the tracks, and they're pretty easy to find. You just talk to some of the refugees hanging around the central train station, they'll tell you exactly where they are. It's easy to get there. It's easy to track, to target them. I mean, essentially, I think it kind of... what we're looking at here is looking at a sense of disjointed the European Union is when it comes to some important issues like dealing with vulnerable people, whether they're migrants, refugees, or in this case, underage migrants.
So in earlier interviews I've done on this issue, there have been criticism of the European authorities for not having an overall strategy and plan. So this obviously extends to this issue of the 10,000 missing children.
Indeed. I mean, they're probably paying attention to them now because Europol is the kind of Europe's counterterrorism intelligence network, and they're, obviously, since Paris, they're concerned to know where people are and to know that people aren't up to nefarious acts. So in this way, they kind of... they draw attention to another area that really they should be interested in strictly on the welfare of the children. Under the rights of the child, all children are entitled to this kind of protection. But so we should have been doing this for some time.
So what can be done then, Leonard Doyle? What could the authorities do now that the barn door is open and the horse is down the paddock?
I mean, it's terribly important that they treat these refugees and migrants as vulnerable people. There is a mood abroad in the European Union at the moment which says it's only the refugees that matter and only those from certain countries are entitled to asylum, so the rest should be deemed to be economic migrants and sent packing. I mean, that's kind of the mood music we're getting in Europe at the moment. And what we are saying in the International Organization for Migration is that kind of broad brush approach is very dangerous because you scoop up in it very vulnerable people, for example, these minors that we're talking about, who are deserving of protection rather than being sent home to a very uncertain future.
So what's happening in Sweden in that regard? You mentioned that the argument is over who's really a refugee whose life's in danger and needs asylum or who is an economic migrant. I understand that not only have there been some ugly scenes in Sweden, which is somewhat unexpected of that country that has a tradition of tolerance, but there's also, I believe, the Swedish authorities are now going to deport 80,000 people.
Well, they're deeming these people to be economic migrants, not worthy, not up to the mark as asylum seekers, not passing muster as asylum seekers. So as a result, they want to get moving and get these people out of the country, back to their original country that they're from. The danger is that they can scoop up in that rush to get to send people home because they're not deemed to be getting asylum, that they send a lot of vulnerable people with them, whether they're people who are entitled to be in the European Union, unaccompanied minors, even accompanied minors. So rather than saying under the Convention for the Rights of the Child, these people, these young folks need and are entitled to support, they tend to just send them packing.
So
they may often be denied access to adequate medical services, education. They can be treated badly by police cards and like. I mean, it runs the gamut.
But in terms of the likely culprits here, in terms of human traffickers or those in the sex trade, predators picking up these children, what other possible scenarios might there be? Would people be just sort of adopting children, who childless couples or... I mean, that's maybe a little fanciful, but what's your sense?
Well, I think it's... I mean, we're talking probably about children who are a bit too old to, you know, fall into the adoption system. They're people who've made the journey. I would imagine that those who come as babes in arms don't exactly get passed along. Mm-hmm. But, the issue is more that their treatment... they tend to be treated in jail-like detention centres, which can be degrading in they're put into cells with adults who are strangers. And then they become, because this is a new economy, if you will, of over a million migrants all struggling to try and make it. And they don't have any money, of course, having paid their smugglers. So there's always the danger that children become pawns in this game and are used in trafficking and child labor or, in the worst cases, for sex trade.
But you mentioned that Europe is open in contrast to the United States, where asylum seekers then would be automatically held in custody until their cases are heard. In Europe, when people arrive, they're not locked up. They're allowed to, go out.
Well, it kind of depends on the country, but in most countries they're not locked up. But sometimes they need protection. They need to be in a safe house, and that safe house may not be available to them. So it's a mixed bag. I mean, you're talking about 32 different countries, all of whom seem to have a completely different view as to whether migrants are entitled to or entitled to stay or not. So there's a lot of dissent within the European Union. Some countries are sitting pretty and saying, well, don't send them our way. Sweden and the United and Germany have had the vast majority of them have come their way. There's been a very generous reception to them, but it's had its own impact on the politics there as well.
Well, but given that most have gone to Germany and to Sweden, is that to suggest that of the 10,000 missing children, most of them went missing in Germany and Sweden?
Well, just judging by the numbers, it's the most likely scenario. That's where they are. So one would assume so. But then there's many in the UK as well. I mean, they tend to suffer from a let's deport them first and ask questions later is the main thing. And that can involve sending vulnerable children back to very dangerous places at a dangerous time. What you find, you know, those who join the migration route, they might not necessarily be doing it because they fear for their lives, but they might be doing it because they have a gender issue, a sexual preference. And then if they get sent back, this may put them directly in the line of fire. So there's a lot of progress needs to be made, I think, in Europe. A lot of more attention needs to be given to vulnerabilities. And this report by Europol is timely in that sense. But it's good that the European Union is finally kind of looking at this for the first time, really.
But surely this indicates the desperation in these countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and particularly Syria, where there's a vicious 5-year-long civil war going on. Parents, do they just basically decide that the only way to protect their children is to send them on this uncertain journey across the Aegean into Europe? And would any of them be given an address to go to, or a relative, or a contact, or are they just cast?
Yeah, some families are just so desperate that they just send them off. I mean, there's a fairly good system, however, to ensure safe delivery, if you like. If you're being smuggled from Afghanistan to Europe, the way the system works is that the fee is paid in advance to the smuggler, but it's not paid directly to the smuggler, it's paid to a third party. And that fee is not released until the person being smuggled, is in fact proven to be alive and on the other side in the country of destination. So, you know, the systems, the irregular migrants, you know, have kind of pretty sophisticated systems to make sure that they get there safely. Of course, the issue is that when people have no jobs, children become very vulnerable.
Well, Leonard Doyle, I thank you very much for filling us in on this appalling and alarming story of the 10,000 children from the migrant tide from the Middle East missing in Europe. And I hope we can stay in touch and get more information on this.
Thank you for calling. It's a pleasure to be asked.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with Leonard Doyle, who's the Director of Media and Communications and spokesperson for the Director General of the International Organization for Migration. He joined us from Switzerland. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to a luxury resort near Palm Springs and speak with Lauren Windsor, who has managed to infiltrate the last two secret Coke conclaves, but this year she's been targeted by Coke security and forced to report from the sidewalk outside the luxury resort.
And you know that there's a place in the sun for all that you've done.
I'd like to buy the Cokes a world so they leave us alone, then go back to Park Avenue and crawl beneath their stone.
Shining sea.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lauren Windsor, the executive producer of The Undercurrent on YouTube and the executive director of American Family Voices, a progressive nonprofit focusing on banking and campaign finance reform. She blogs under the name Lady Libertine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lauren Windsor.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And Lady Libertine, you have been consigned to the pavement outside this luxury resort where the Koch brothers are holding their conclave of with their donor network, who have spent close to $400 million last year. And they're on their way to spending an extraordinary $889 million supporting right-wing politics and politicians and causes in this 2016 election. So tell us about, I mean, you infiltrated the last two of these secret Koch conclaves. I take it Koch security have figured out who you are.
Yeah, I would say so. That was I was made pretty quickly, but you know, I'm still getting information. I was at the resort on Thursday night and was able to sit directly behind Richard Fink, their so-called brand strategist, and overheard a conversation that he was having with some of his communication staff that they had prepped USA Today reporter Frederica Schouten, and so I found the usage of the word prep to be pretty interesting. I've never heard of anyone referring to, you know, talking to a reporter as prepping them. It has the connotation of just, like, feeding somebody a press release.
Well, but that's what's very puzzling about this. They've normally kept the press out, and you somehow are able to get into these last two and record enormous amount of stuff, a lot of which was used in Jane Mayer's new book on the Koch brothers and the origins of the family's fortune, which ironically comes from two of the worst dictators of the in history, and certainly of the 20th century, Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler. However, the what are the ground rules under which reporters are being...
Let me clarify something, though, Ian.
Yeah.
Actually, I did not record the audio that came out of the 2014 June retreat. I had a source that recorded that audio and then gave it to me. So that was not me, but, you know, I was lucky to have a source that was present and was able to get it. With regards to the ground rules that other reporters have to play by, they let six outlets into this retreat, according to NBC News, an article that came out this morning, on the condition that they preserve the anonymity of the donors. So, you know, if you're a favored press outlet, then you get entree, but you're not exactly allowed to do any critical reporting of what they're actually doing. Charles Koch, according to this NBC article, in his speech said, you know, we're not a secret cabal. And then, you know, they had a panel on the First Amendment yesterday, which is pretty ironic given that they were trying to quash my First Amendment right to free press, freedom of the press, trying to keep me off of a public sidewalk.
So what happened? Did the Koch brothers securities try and move you from in front of the hotel? Because they've taken over the entire hotel, right?
So, yeah, whenever they're here, they block out the, you know, they lock down the entire hotel, buy out all the rooms. You know, they came out here, and first it was just the hotel security that came and said that it was a private sidewalk. And, you know, honestly, I wasn't buying it, but I moved a little bit further down from where I was. I wasn't that close, but I was close enough that I could still see which cars were going into the entryway. And so I moved a little bit further down, and then he came back with two clothes. Police officers, and what I mean by clothes is in their uniforms. And so they came over to me and gave me a notice of criminal trespass. You know, that if basically that I was aware of what the boundary was, and that if I crossed over that, I would be charged. But then I asked for clarification of what the property line was, because I didn't believe that it was not a public sidewalk. And the sheriff, the police officers were forced to acquiesce to that demand of, you know, I'm going to exercise my First Amendment constitutional rights up to the very point that I can. I said, I'm happy to comply with, you know, the legal requirements here. I'm not going to step on anybody's private property, but you're also not going to deny me my rights. And at that point, they were forced to check to see what the boundary was. And once they figured out that it was indeed a public sidewalk, I got even closer to where I was before. I was actually, they had to allow me to get right next to the entry to the resort within like 10 feet of the tent where they were doing their check-ins of people. And so then that forced them to relocate their check-in tent probably like 50 yards further into the property.
And again, I'm speaking with Lauren Windsor, who's executive producer of The Undercurrent on YouTube and the executive director of American Family Voices. She joins us from outside of the luxury resort near Palm Springs that the Koch brothers have taken over this weekend for their meeting of, in fact, this is the greatest amount of their billionaire, wealthy conservative network that have gathered so far. And they have put up $889 billion get their people elected in this election cycle, having spent $400 million so far in 2015. And in the David Koch's opening remarks, of course, he said that he's dedicated to protecting free speech, which is under attack everywhere. What an irony. you can't go into that building. They're trying to throw you off the sidewalk in front of the building. That's hardly an exercise in protecting free speech.
Right. And I mean, I was even a patron of the resort, and now not only am I not allowed to go onto the resort grounds during the duration of the event, but henceforth, even after this is over, I'm not allowed onto the property. So that just goes to show you, who the hotel really cares about, but also the police themselves. I mean, I question the police as to whether or not they were acting like on-duty police officers or whether they had been contracted as off-duty, and they told me no comment. So I think it's a pretty gross hypocrisy when you have this clearly, like, virulently anti-government billionaire using the resources of the government to avoid public scrutiny. This is the antithesis of what the founders would have imagined in setting up our democracy.
Well, but the question is, are we a democracy or are we an oligarchy or a plutocracy?
Well, right. This is what I'm saying. Is they, like, they're basically, you know, the term, like, Bible beater, Bible thumper? These people are like constitution thumpers, constitution beaters. They beat it to death. My constitutional right, my First Amendment right. Well, you know, your First Amendment right to free speech isn't free. There's a cost to that. There's freedom of the press. There's public scrutiny. And it's hypocritical to sit there and thump the Constitution while denying the public an opportunity to see exactly what it is they're doing. You know, they're corrupting our democracy. It is the height of hypocrisy.
But Lauren Windsor, obviously you're not inside, but there have been some press reports about what's been going on inside the Indian Wells luxury resort and spa near Palm Springs in the Coachella Valley, which the Koch brothers have taken over for this weekend. And there's 500 of their billionaire cohorts there putting up close to $1 billion to elect their people. But who are their people now? I mean, particularly in terms of president, they've got to be freaking out that Donald Trump is a fellow billionaire who they don't own, is way ahead, and Adelson's there amongst the billionaires, and he's been putting his bets on Rubio, who's a little hand puppet of his. What do you hear from about what's going on inside in terms of who they're buying and how they're going to stop Trump?
Well, that's not exactly clear to me. I mean, it is clear that, you know, they're not fans of Trump. Another thing that, you know, was said in this, like, update to Fink from his press team was, you know, the press are wanting you to comment on Donald Trump. And he's like, I don't want to talk about Donald Trump. And, the 2015, this last summer retreat, they had five of the candidates. Cruz was one of them. So, you know, they've got Cruz and Rubio. You know, clearly no one sees Bush as a real contender right now, but Bush was there also.
Bush, is that is he not in Iowa today? He's there, you mean, in Palm Springs?
No. I wasn't meaning here in Palm Springs. He was at the summer retreat.
I see. Well, he's down at 2% in this poll from the Des Moines Register in Iowa. So, what the Koch brothers are clearly really about is they're about financing the denial of global warming to protect their oil and gas and pipeline interests. That seems to me all of their political libertarianism is window dressing for the bottom line of where their wealth is concentrated. And does anybody get that this is really about plutocrats protecting their interests, and they're doing it at the expense of humanity in the case of global warming? They've got people like Glenn, what's his name, that horrible guy, the right-wing talk show guy, who's on there.
Glenn Beck.
Yeah, Glenn Beck. I mean, he's a big a supporter of Cruz, but, I mean, he's out there. You know, he actually, the other day on his talk shows, called President of the United States a dumb SOB because he believed in global warming. So that seems to be what they're really about. I've got to wrap it up now. I'm getting a signal. But what's your sense of whether that real focus is there?
Well, I mean, I think Jane Mayer has been, pretty on target with them about who they really are and what they're up to. More than any other journalist, in response to the Koch audio that came out, he really dug into the session with Richard Fink, where he talked about well-being and the PR effort around well-being, where he says, you know, they're not buying the product that we're selling, so we have to change our branding. And she, I said that when I wrote my article, but none of the press is willing to report on it, because they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them. They do not want to lose access to the Koch brothers.
Well, clearly they've got access to this conclave, at least some of them. I thank you very much, and they've accepted the ground rules. I thank you very much, Lauren Windsor. I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lauren Windsor, the executive producer of The Undercurrent on YouTube and the executive director of American Family Voices, a progressive nonprofit focusing on banking and campaign finance reform. She blogs under the name Lady Libertine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.